From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A series of explosions rocked an area near a military academy in the Afghan capital Kabul early Monday, less than 48 hours after a Taliban suicide bombing killed hundreds and wounded others. Mohammed Daoud was one of the victims of Saturday's blast, said he saw a lot of people killed and wounded laying around him. It was the worst such attack in the city since a May truck bombing killed 150, comes a week after a Taliban assault on the Intercontinental Hotel that left more than 20 dead. In a statement, the Taliban said it was sending a message to President Donald Trump, warning against what it called a policy of aggression. Indiana University anthropology professor, native Afghan Nazif Shirani, was asked if Pakistan is complicit in these attacks.
Absolutely, absolutely. There is no doubt about anybody's mind in Afghanistan that these are done by the order of Pakistan. Pakistanis make a point to Trump, don't push us too much and we can cause more harm.
Early this month, the Trump administration cut military aid to Islamabad until it does something about terror safe havens on its soil. The 30th African Union Summit is underway in Addis Ababa. Among those attending, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
I stand here on behalf of the United Nations system and reaffirm our strong commitment to the member states and the people of Africa. I strongly believe Africa is one of the greatest forces for good in our world.
55 heads of state are attending. The theme of this year's meeting, fight against corruption. AU Commission Chairman Moussa Faki Mohamed urged South Sudan's warring factions to reach a lasting peace or face sanctions and called on Democratic Republic of Congo to hold elections later this year as planned. This is VOA News. Turkish forces and their Syrian rebel allies Sunday claimed to have seized Mount Barsaya near the Kurdish town of Afrin in northwest Syria as they press a week-long offensive to clear the Turkish-Syrian frontier of Kurdish militia viewed as a security threat. The mount is a key objective separating the Kurdish-held enclave of Afrin from the Turk-controlled town of Azaz. Kurdish defenders, known as the YPG, dispute the Turkish claim. The Syrian Observatory of Human Rights said dozens, both fighters and civilians, died in Sunday's fighting. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Sunday vowed to clean the entire border area of terrorists. Meanwhile, UN Goodwill Ambassador and actress Angelina Jolie visited a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan Sunday and called for an end to the nearly seven-year conflict.
The fundamental issue is not that people don't know, but the lack of a credible political and diplomatic process based on human rights and international law to bring the violence to an end.
The UN estimates Syria's neighbors care for over 5 million Syrian refugees. In Yemen, at least 10 have been killed in fighting for control of the port city Aden between the Saudi-backed government of President Abdrabo Mansur Hadi and one-time separatist allies supported by the United Arab Emirates. The separatists have demanded the dismissal of the prime minister and his cabinet. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Sunday criticized a draft Polish law that would make it illegal to suggest Poland bore any responsibility for Nazi atrocities on its soil during World War II. Mr. Netanyahu said there is no tolerance for distorting the truth, for rewriting history, or for Holocaust denial. Poland's deputy ambassador to Israel insisted the law was designed to safeguard, not whitewash, history. Germany invaded and occupied Poland in 1939 and erected death camps there. Nearly 5 million Jewish and non-Jewish Poles perished during the war. Cypriot President Nikos Anastasiadis faces a runoff against leftist Stavros Malis February 4. After Sunday's first round, the result could determine whether peace talks with Turkish Cypriots continue. The dispute has split the Greek and Turkish communities since the 1960s. In Finland, President Sauli Niinisto easily won a second-year, six-year term in Sunday's election, capturing nearly two-thirds of the vote. He's advanced a cautious policy of friendship with Russia while maintaining European Union membership. The billionaire founder of globally popular Swedish furniture company IKEA, Ingvar Kamprad, has died. He was 91. Meanwhile, cartoonist Mort Walker, creator of the work-avoiding Army private Beetle Bailey, has died, age 94. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the 16th day of January, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Political transition is underway in Liberia as a new Speaker of the House of Representatives has been elected.
We'll try to ensure that we help to rebrand the legislature so that economically, politically, and socially, the people will be prioritized. And the spirit of inclusiveness will be enhanced.
Representative Bofal Chambers is the newly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives. A group of South Sudan elders will mediate the dispute between the government and a renegade army chief of staff. Zambia begins a week of fasting prayers for cholera. And Somalia's Al-Shabaab is accused of abducting children for indoctrination and military training.
Over the last 3 months of 2017, Al-Shabaab were going into some of these villages, pressuring elders, teachers in the local duksis to hand over children as young as 8 years old.
Letitia Beda is a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. And political parties in South Africa ban on corruption as a 2019 election issue. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Liberia, political transition from the government of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf to that of President-elect George Weah is underway in preparation for Monday's inauguration. Yesterday, outgoing Vice President Joseph Boakai turned over his notes to incoming Vice President Jewel Howard Taylor. Also yesterday, the 54th legislature began work with the election of Representative Bofal Chambers as the new Speaker of the House of Representatives. He is a member of George Weah's Coalition for Democratic Change. Chambers tells VOA that the House of Representatives under his leadership will prioritize the interests of the people by adopting a pro-poor agenda.
We'll try to ensure that we help to rebrand the legislature so that economically, politically, and socially, the people will be prioritized and the spirit of inclusiveness will be enhanced. We'll also try to make certain that our legislation be pro-poor and also that the people's interests be prioritized. We'll try to also be independent but will coordinate so as to have comprehensive and constructive checks and balances in our work.
Prior to your election, there was concern that perhaps the CDC, which you represent, was entering into some kind of collusion with some members of the Unity Party. Do you think you will be able to check on the administration of the new president?
Well, yeah, basically, we will coordinate. We will differ when we have to. But the country needs unity. The country needs prosperity. The country needs justice. And we intend to be the bulwark for justice for our people. Aligning with the Unity Party is to ensure that they have our confidence, our trust, because we feel that together we can achieve greater things. But we are not trying to put them into submission. They will be as clear as they are in terms of their own agenda. But I see no reason why checks and balances will not be ensured. If you all are there to make our government work. So we will encourage them to voice their differences and to put our feet to the fire.
Mr. Speaker-elect, I don't want to say maybe that the speakership of the Liberian legislature is a toxic position, but I think I will be right to say that the two speakers before you had to, I think one of them had to be removed for alleged corruption. What assurance can you give the Liberian people that you will do their business and that you will not be involved in anything that have to do with corruption?
For us, we feel that service should be the calling of people of public trust. So we will come to ensure that public trust is upheld. We are answerable to our people. So anything wrong we do against their interest, they have the right to take action that will match our own acts. So knowing that the speakership is not an inheritance for anybody, it's a privilege. So that is why we will pray to do our best and we know with God on our side we'll succeed. and we'll put the people's first at all times. Our legislature will be people-centered legislature.
During the administration of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, there were allegations that perhaps the southeastern region of the country was abandoned, that not much attention was paid to the counties in the southeastern region. Now, you are from the southeastern region. The president-elect, George Weah, is from the southeastern region. Is it most likely for people to say that perhaps you will pay attention to your region?
We will not pitch a kind of politics based on regionalism. We will give some emphasis in the southeast, but we'll also include other parts of the country because Lofa also has challenges. Limba has challenges. Papulu has challenges. Cape Mount has challenges. And it's all over. So we will do our best and we'll make certain that the resources will best serve our people. Maybe there have been some gaps in the management architecture for the outgoing government. The government has done its best. We think those achievements made, we will capitalize on those ones. Those things that were not done properly will be guided against them so that we can ensure that those things that have been eluding our people will now come to a reality that they may benefit from those things.
Soon after the election, President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf tried to push through some legislative agenda or some bills. Is this 54th session of the legislature likely to pick up those bills or what?
Well, all bills that are resting with us, we'll try to look at them, scrutinize them. Those ones that we need to pass now, we may pass them now. Those ones that need maybe some cleaning up, we're cleaning up, but I leave that to the judgment of my colleagues. I know they will act judiciously and do the people work properly.
Mr. Speaker-elect, we thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa, and congratulations again.
Well, thank you. I'm elated. I'm humbled. And we hope and pray that where I come from, a place called Flebo Sodope District, and I call that New Jerusalem. Yeah, good things can come from New Jerusalem. And we are certain the library will have a new face and the legislature will be rebranded.
Representative Beaufort Chambers is the newly elected Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. A New York-based rights group says Somalia's al-Shabaab militants have forced rural communities to hand over their children for indoctrination and military training. Human Rights Watch says al-Shabaab has ordered elders, teachers in Islamic religious schools and communities in rural areas to hand over children as young as 8 or face attack. The group says since late September last year, al-Shabaab's recruitment campaign has focused on the Bay region in southwestern Somalia, where communities there were already ravaged by droughts and years of conflict. Letitia Bader, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, says the report is based on interviews with families affected by al-Shabaab recruitment activities.
As we know, I mean, targeting educational institutions, students, both for indoctrination but also to recruit children as fighters has been very much part of al-Shabaab's campaign in Somalia for over a decade. But what we've been seeing over the last year has been an effort to intimidate and force communities. Now, what we were looking in particular were a series of communities in the Bay region in rural areas. So these are communities which have already been hit by drought, very poor, struggling to survive. And over the last 3 months of 2017, al-Shabaab were going into some of these villages, pressuring elders, teachers in the local duksis to hand over children as young as 8 years old. Sometimes they forcibly abducted the children from these classrooms. Other times they said to the community that they had 10 days. They abducted elders and told them, you know, in exchange for your freedom, you have to hand over children. And as a result, what we were seeing in the Bay region is that communities' only option to protect their children from recruitment was to send them into government-controlled towns, often on their own, just to see if they can get a bit more protection in those towns.
Al-Shabaab is notorious for recruiting underage children. What are they going to do with 8 years old? Are they going to send them to front lines?
We've obviously seen in the past some very young children sent to the front line, some children as young as 9 years old being used very much as cannon fodder right at the front lines. And this, you know, we saw it very much during the fighting in Mogadishu in 2010, 2011. We've seen it more recently also in a large-scale offensive in Puntland in 2016. But what appears to be part of this campaign is actually to get these children to go to al-Shabaab managed, controlled madrasas, to put them through what is their educational system. And then in some cases, obviously, there is a link between children going through these schools and then being sent on to military training.
So how many children are we talking about were here affected by this recruitment, say, within the last 6 months or 1 year?
It's very difficult to know and to follow up. I mean, you know, a lot of these communities are very much both, you know, in al-Shabaab controlled areas, but it's very difficult to monitor. I mean, what we know is that there have been hundreds of children who have been ending up in government controlled towns. So, you know, we are talking about a number of villages in these different areas which have been affected. In my own research, I mean, just in one tiny little village, 50 children were picked up from a school just on two occasions. I mean, according to the UN, we are talking about hundreds of children who are being abducted. Now, some of those are being abducted and taken to madrasa schools and might not end up on the front line. But as I was saying, a lot of these do end up somehow within the ranks of al-Shabaab as well.
Is anybody doing anything about it? What can be done?
Now, I mean, of course, in the short term, what has been key is making sure that the children who've been sent to some of these government-controlled towns are identified, are receiving basic protection and potentially access to education.
Letitia Beda is a senior Africa researcher at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She spoke with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, January 16th. Daybreak Africa time is 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Zambia's information minister says cases of the three-month-long cholera outbreak have been dropping following measures the government has been implementing. Kampamba Mulanga's comments came after the government declared a week of fasting prayers for citizens beginning yesterday, Monday. The administration has asked the church to join the war against the cholera outbreak. Opposition groups have accused the government of failing to come up with effective strategies to resolve the outbreak. But Information Minister Mulenga tells viewers Peter Clotty that the government would not be sidetracked in its efforts to end the cholera outbreak by opposition criticisms.
Actually, we've had a continued reduction in the number of new cholera cases. And I can attest that in the last 24 hours, we've had 29 cases compared to the 68 recorded over the same period. And of course, just because we have had this reduction in the number of new cases, it does not mean that we as government obviously are going to relent despite the scaling down of the risk level.
The government has also come out with a one-week prayers for spiritual intervention in this matter. If the government policies appear to be working, as you have enumerated, what is the significance of this one-week spiritual intervention?
First and foremost, you must know that Zambia is a Christian nation and our pillar is Christianity. And of course, as cabinet, we did agree that we do have a 1 week of prayer and fasting because we are Christians and we believe in God's intervention. And of course, we've had a rough start in terms of this cholera epidemic. And of course, we've had a slow rain pattern. So there's a lot to pray for in our country. And I think there's nothing new about it by virtue of us being declared a Christian nation.
The opposition politicians are also Christians, but they are saying that this is a ploy by the government as a face-saving measure for failed policies, and that it is also going to be used by the government to silence opposition criticisms for the government's failure to resolve this cholera outbreak, which has led to delay of opening of schools and the closure of some schools despite government repeated promises.
We've had this trend of our colleagues in the opposition not trying to participate in prayers. So this is nothing new to us. They've never participated in our prayers, our National Day of Prayer and Fasting. So even when they say things like that, they do not shock us. So I think more than ever, our colleagues in the opposition should have been more patriotic in participating to ensure that we scale down the numbers. And I want to assure you that we have not failed to scale down these numbers. I just said in the last 24 hours, we had 68 reported cases of cholera. And just as of today, the numbers have drastically reduced. So I don't see where they, how from 68 to 29, we are failing to contain this epidemic. One of the measures that government had to put in is to ensure that these schools were shut down so that we can contain this disease. So any responsible government would have put up this measure. And before we could actually review on the 30th, we have done tremendously well, and that is why our children are actually going back to school. So I don't really get what prayer and fasting have got to do with failed policies.
There are still ongoing protests with marketers who say that the government forcibly uses the army to remove them from the places without providing them with an alternative for them to do their business. How do you respond to that?
We believe as a government that those riots in Kanyama were politically motivated. You see, Kanyama is not the only epicenter that was recorded cases of cholera, but why a particular area? So for us, we have alternatives, and we're going to give our people the best alternative. But government will have to act responsible and put our people in trading areas where this outbreak cannot erupt again. And we must ensure that we make decisions in the best interest of our people.
Kapamba Mulenga is Zambia's information minister. She spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. A group of South Sudan elders who call themselves concerned citizens will soon travel to the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to meet with former SPLA chief of staff, General Paul Malong Awan, to mediate and resolve the conflict between the Salva Kiir government and the former army chief of staff. The move comes shortly after the government accused Malong of mobilizing rebel army officers. Wake Simawudu has the report for VOA from Juba.
Presidential spokesman Atteni Wek Atteni says the group of community elders led by former South Sudan ambassador to the United Nations, Francis Deng, asked for permission from President Salva Kiir last Thursday to travel to Kenya and meet with Malong. The decision to mediate between Malong and the government follows an announcement by the government early last week that Malong has rebelled against the Kiir administration. Atteni told the reporters the government had audio tapes of secretly recorded conversations in which Malong instructed army officers to rebel and topple the Kiir administration, an accusation Malong denies. Atteni says Mr. Kiir has given the elders the go-ahead to meet with Malong.
Well, there were no issues in detail, simply because the committee was only asking the president to allow them to travel. The president gave them the permission to go.
A letter the group wrote to President Kiir and viewed by South Sudan in Focus indicates the group of the elders will travel anytime now to Nairobi to consult with Malong, and is composed of 9 elders, including various lawmakers and Bishop Isaiah Majok Dau. It's the same group of elders that mediated talks to resolve the dispute between Mr. Kiir and Malong in November last year. Following those talks, Malong was freed from house arrest in Juba and allowed to travel outside the country for medical treatment. Atteni says Mr. Kiir welcomes any initiatives aimed at resolving a conflict between the government and General Malong.
The president, Salva Kiir, is someone who loves peace. And if there is peace, even in the forests of Colombia, President Salva Kiir can go for it.
According to the letter, Member of Parliament Maker Thiong Mal is expected to be one of the concerned members to meet with Malong in Nairobi. Thiong says the group wants to try to understand what Malong is thinking.
One cannot actually try to read out what is in the mind of General Malong. One would be mistaken just to read the mind of somebody. Is it not better to listen to somebody of what are his grievances actually? And then from there, you discuss.
Thiong, who was at Malong's site fighting against the Khartoum regime during the Juba Khartoum Revolution, says up until recently, Malong was a respected member of the SPLA.
General Malong is one of the who have done a lot for this nation, and even the president knows him very well, and he's also a right-hand man of the president.
President Kiir dismissed Malong as chief of staff in May 2017. Malong left Juba through Yirol on his way to his ancestral home in Awil. Eastern Lakes state officials persuaded Malong to return to Juba on the orders of President Kiir, who placed him under house arrest from May to November. Some human rights groups say Malong is responsible for human rights abuses committed by the South Sudan Army during his time as chief of staff. The United States imposed sanctions on Malong and two other officials in September last year, accusing them of orchestrating the conflict. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Africa's two top political parties began the year by pledging to restore credibility amid corruption allegations against key leaders. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg that as next year's elections draw closer, South Africa's political players are driving home the message that corruption is their main target.
The ruling African National Congress and embattled President Jacob Zuma have long been accused of corruption. Critics of the government say this has left the state unable to carry out basic duties. But Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, who succeeded Zuma as the ANC's top leader last month, says that will change. Here he is in the coastal city of East London over the weekend, taking several not-so-subtle jabs at Zuma, who was accused of siphoning off tens of millions of dollars and of letting a wealthy Indian family have undue influence over the government.
These challenges have been exacerbated by state capture through which billions of rands have been illegally diverted to individuals, corruption in state-owned enterprises and other public institutions have undermined our government's programs to address poverty and unemployment, and they have weakened those institutions.
The ANC has dominated national politics for a quarter century, but has lost ground in recent years to the opposition Democratic Alliance, which captured three major cities in 2016's municipal polls. Meanwhile, the DA is having its own reckoning, charging Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille with corruption under the party's own disciplinary process. De Lille reported to work Monday, but her party relegated many key responsibilities, like the city's dire water crisis, to other officials. In Johannesburg, the city's mayor said Monday he was firing a top city finance official amid allegations of nepotism and undue influence. Party leader Musi Maimane spoke to reporters Sunday in Cape Town.
The true test of any political party is what it does when confronted with serious allegations of political dysfunction, maladministration, and governance failures. The DA, unlike many of our political competitors, stands largely alone in acting with resolve in confronting such issues.
That's viewers Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. And that is it for this Tuesday, January 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com.
The news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.